access number 14981, Phil Cornell, Reel 7.
Mr. Cornell, Reel 7, you'd been doing this training for assault craft and so on.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How long were you on that?
Well, actually, the actual, we trained in the camper, but the actual positive training that was on the actual ship, I think it happened twice in about a 12-month period. And both times it was on this ship. It was a beautiful little ship. It was a land craft ship. It was called the Deneira, roughly 11,000 tons, where it was air conditioned and things like that. And it was a very interesting little ship. And the training was interesting as well.
So you were training basically to make an assault from the sea?
Exactly, exactly. That was from scrambling down these nets hung over the side. Down into the landing craft, they would be lowered first, the land craft be lowered, then you were down there scrambling nets into the assault landing craft, and driven about for a bit. It was quite entertaining, quite good really, with the equipment, and then to make a landing onto a beach, and how to get off it and whatnot, and then back onto the boat and back to the ship and back up the nets and back and into your bunk again.
At this period, when you're in this camp, training camp, were they beginning to tell you about the Japanese as a soldier and what to look for and what to expect?
I would think from our own officers, the intelligence officers and whatnot, the conversation, it went away from the Japanese. We were given lectures about how bad the Russians were and things like that. And I remember this day an officer pulling a coin out of his pocket, his intelligence officer, was going to this lecture, and it was a Russian coin. And it had the emblem of the world with the Russian hammer and sickle over the world. And so he kept pointing out this was the Russians' aim, was the domination of the world. We couldn't care less at that stage who it was.
Yet these were our allies at
yes,
that time.
Exactly, exactly. Yes, that's quite true, that's quite true. So there must have been this, that instruction must have came from head up somewhere, but where goodness knows.
How long were you doing this training in this camp?
In the camp? Do you mean daily or weekly? Or
the period of time from arriving and then moving on.
Well, it was always training till we get to the next part. Now, the next stage were we started to get into jungle training. And that was quite a different kettle of fish. Now, we were taught jungle training, but really we'd never had much experience of jungle. So, in our case, our battalion, I don't know about the other battalions, I can only speak of my own, where we entrained and went to, in southern India, a place called Belgaum, which was jungle country. And we went to the jungle, and there we were trained and taught jungle warfare.
Can you tell me what kind of training that was?
Well, the atmosphere, everything was different completely because it was thick jungle and it was hard work because you had these machetes, you had to bash your way through this undergrowth and bamboo and whatnot, and then you had your normal training, army training on top of that, but the jungle, it was the environment what they were interested in, training you to fight a completely different soldier in a jungle where you couldn't say much and things like that. And it was basically the same army train, but it was under different conditions completely. And that was the jungle train, but there was nothing. The army train was still basic, it was just the same.
So they took you out into the jungle?
Yes.
To do whatever it was they wanted you to do?
Mm-hmm. Yes. But looking back now, it was obviously intended at that stage that our role as a division, battalion and a division, had completely changed. Because up till then, as I say, we hadn't been trained in jungle warfare. We'd been trained more in amphibious assault than jungle warfare. So obviously that there was something afoot and our role had been changed. Because obviously later it was disclosed that we were who were trained in a hurry because they knew there was trouble on the borders of India.
Do you recall what period of time this was?
As near as I can remember, it would be... it'd been 1944, I think. Or 1945, I'm not sure which, one of the two, I think. It was the period round about the beginning of the year when we went to Belgaum. And of course, the Assam battle would start sometime about March, end of March or middle of March, somewhere about that. And that would, I think it would be 1944, was that right?
Hmm. What skills actually of moving in the jungle and fighting in the jungle were they trying to tell you?
Yes, well, we were taught the basic training really, but it was new, that if you were in position, they got this sort of idea that if you were in a box, what you call a box, you were completely safe. So the box was meant that if you were formed a defensive box, even a platoon or a group or a company or a battalion even, a box, you were self-contained, you were in that box, and the enemy force, in our case Japanese, could come any way they wanted, left, right, centre, east, north, south, east, west, and they could shoot them, but they could never get into that box, because it was a group and you had protection right round by the other groups as well. You had one small part of the cover with your fires and your guns, ammunition, things like that. But as a box, you were a unit, and it didn't matter which way you were surrounded, cut off, you were independent, and you could fight on. Now, that was the basic training. It was meant, up to that stage, if you got cut off, everybody panicked. They were all like World War One, World War Two, and different other theatres. If you got cut off, you were in trouble, and everybody panicked, and you tried to get out the best way you can. But this new training made the point that wherever you were, whatever, you stuck where you were. You formed this box, which was purely a defensive box, and they couldn't get you, and if you got cut off, you would be supplied by air.
How would the box be formed, thinking in terms of your company or battalion that formed the box? Why, how was it done?
Yes, why, you'd have, it, call it a circle. It wasn't a circle, obviously, because most of the things are circle. It turned on the terrain, and you filled a fire and things like that. But each section, each section, would have an arc and an area in front of them, which it was their duty to watch all the time, and to cover, not to worry about further round, either left, right, centre, but look after your own particular spot. And in that way, there was no weak links in the box at all. It was covered right away around. You can only assume a circle, but of course, as I say, the conditions meant there wasn't a circle.
Moving through the jungle, you said you had machetes to cut you with.
That's right. Yeah.
How did you actually move through?
Well, in single file we went, always in single file. And you took turns with the machete at the front. If it was thick scrub and that, you took turns because it was hard work, believe me. And it wasn't pleasant work half the time because on top of the, in the rainy season especially, you had things like leeches and things like that, which were a nasty nuisance. The leeches would come, all of a sudden you just look down and you see leeches on your various parts of your bodies, and the thing then be was to touch them with a cigarette and they would drop off. We were taught never to pull them off, because if you pulled them off, you're a hospital case in there, because you would get poison where it left its part of its head in your skin.
Another important use of the cigarette.
That's true, that's quite true, yep. Mm-hmm.
So you're moving in single file by section, platoon? Or
yes, but as I say, you couldn't say all you were involved with your particular small group of men. You could be making, another section could be maybe 10 or 15 feet to your right or left and doing the same thing, but you're moving forward, each group in a single file.
So you'd hear them, but you wouldn't be able to see them.
That's true, but you also are taught not to make as much noise, to make as little noise as possible. That was unavoidable when we were cutting through branches and things like that, but you were taught to make as little noise as possible and not respond. Another thing you were taught even at that stage was if you heard a voice shout, "No, tell me anything to you in the jungle," to completely ignore it, never to answer it back, because the Japanese were noted in that respect for finding out where your position was through this particular incident. They would call out, "Tommy, how are you getting on, things like that, waiting for a response. And as soon as somebody spoke up, right, they had you pinpointed, you know exactly where you were.
How did you, or how was a place chosen for staying overnight in the jungle? You're moving down during the day, where would you stop?
There was, like any other, like I would in England or anywhere else, invariably there was little clearings here and there, and these were the third place you made your overnight camp in. And they tried always to give you 1 hot mile a day, and that was when you reached this night camp stoppage place where the cook got too busy and made you some form of a hot meal. Basically, the ingredient was bully beef, but never mind, it was a change from having it out of a tin.
It would have to be used with great care, heating in the jungle.
Oh, yes. Well, they had the portable burners, you know, which worked by petrol. And again, just a trench dug in the ground. And the Dixies were cooking across the top then. There was this burner placed at one end of the trench, and it shot flames along maybe through six of these big Dixies what were cooking the food.
How were these brought up, the heavier stuff?
Quite frankly, don't know. They seemed always to be there.
Did you have?
But I can only presume that the cooks would carry what they could. Oh, we had they had mules and things like that, which would carry the heavy equipment like that. Mm-hmm. That's right, I've missed this little part out. No, it comes back as you go along. The battalion at that time, before we left for Belgaum, had been given a company of mules. And they're the strange looking animals with a will of their own. And they had volunteers out of the various groups and sections who went into this, the mule unit to look after the mules. And the golden rule was that the mule was far more important than the man that was handling the mule. And I remember quite well when, even from the day one in Gettingham, if you went out on train or anywhere, the mule had to be watered and fed and everything else before you got your own mule. You were second to the mule.
Did you get any opportunity to drive these animals?
Once over, yes. And I found out the unpleasant way that it's one animal who can kick sideways instead of frontwards and backwards. Horrible things.
But they did have your own men driving them.
That's right. They weren't Indians.
No,
they were white troops. It was the mule company.
And presumably these carried their heavy equipment,
weapons.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
What did the men think of them?
The mules? actually... With some ridicule, really, as we always call them, but I don't think there's any doubt in any soldier's mind that they were a very useful thing to have.
So you arrive and you decide upon a spot to stay the night. What positions did you take up within that area?
Well, you took up your normal defensive position.
Which was the
box.
And
this was the box again, whether if you were section, it was a smaller box, or it was a bit bigger and so on right the way up. Even the whole thing would be formed in the battalion box, but you can only remember your specific little part of the war. It's that you don't really know what was happening. You can only assume that it was the same as your little part, but multiplied. But that was then, you had a chance, of course, Belgaum. I remember it for two things, actually. One of them was the baboons up in the trees. Now, they were fantastic, enormous things, bigger than a man in some cases, and they were swinging about and screaming above your heads. They didn't like being disturbed, and we were disturbing them. And for no reason whatsoever, they would tear a lump off a branch and throw it down, hurl it down at you, things like that. And we'd have loved to put a roundup to us, but we didn't, of course. We'd have been punished severely if we had it done. The same with shooting a bird or anything like that. The kites, the hawks. Part of the sanitary system of India and Burma and the Far East. You weren't allowed to kill anything like that. That was one thing which I remember vividly, was this colony of great big baboons. And they were really like human beings, the way they used to scream at you and hurl things at you. And the second thing was kind of, I used to, you know, I don't know why looking back, I took some awful chances, but I used to tend to wander a bit from Mjorn and get out of touch with Mjorn section and whatnot, for no apparent reason and being curious. And I remember straying a little bit one day among these clumps of bamboo, and I just danced up at a branch not far above me, and there was this great big black animal. And I'd never seen any such thing. Well, on recollection, going back, it must have been a panther, a black panther, or something like that. Of course, all it did was bare its teeth at me and disappeared, and I was mightily relieved. That was one thing. The second thing which I remember about Bill Gormtrain was another little forage on my own. I came across these things grown on a tree which looked very much like what we used to call locusts back in England, what is children we used to get in a lucky packet, a sort of black sweet thing, like a pod. And they looked very much like that, so to my woe, I decided to try one. And it tasted fine, nothing like the locusts which I remembered from my younger days. But I remember 2 days afterward I was violently sick and diarrhea and had all sorts of pleasant things happen to me. Of course, it cleared up in a few days with a few tablets off the MO and back to square one again.
In the middle of the jungle at night, you've come to a spot, you've stopped, you've took up your defensive positions. Mm-hmm. What was the immediate task you had to do then?
Well, the thing was, you know, you weren't, some of you were allowed to sleep. You couldn't go on without sleep, obviously. But the thing was in the jungle, which I must mention because it's a thing which sticks in my mind evermore, and that was the noise. You think of jungles as quiet places. Well, actually, it's just the opposite. The noises were absolutely terrible all night long. You heard animals, you heard jackals and hyenas and things like which you rarely saw them, but you certainly heard them. And that went on all night. Then, of course, there was the crickets. Now, you think crickets can't make any noise, but millions of crickets do make a noise, believe me, and it's a loud noise as well. And one would start up, then next minute would crescendo, they'd all join in, and that's how it used to go at night time. But very noisy, and strange, actually. I wouldn't say it was frightening, but made you aware of where you were, in other words.
Was it difficult to pick out human noise from all this cacophony?
You could, really, but obviously at times it was drowned by the noise, but it was a different kind of noise completely to what a human voice was or anything like that. The only human voice you'd hear in the noise would be somebody quite close to you.
Did you dig in?
Yes, everywhere you went. That was your first thing, you had to dig a hole.
How difficult was it digging in the jungle?
Well, sometimes it's all right, sometimes it's not. But in the jungle, you must imagine that the biggest problem was roots, you see, not like ordinary soil where you could go and dig a hole. The hole as such was nothing like a hole or a trench, a slip trench as you used to call them. That's what you made anywhere else in the world, because you didn't get much down very far before you hit roots, so it was more like a hollow scooped out of the ground. And you tried to get down in that as low as you could. Well, as I say, but this was only training at this particular time, so that aspect you weren't particularly worried about.
Yes, we're still talking about the training aspect and your introduction, really, to jungle life.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Were you being taught how to live off the jungle?
Yes, we were taught a bit later on in the jungle training about things, what to look for, what you could eat, and things what you weren't. I can't remember what they all were now, but we were taught this. But we were told all the way along that not to worry about things like that, because basically, which proved to be true, we would be, if we couldn't be fed by land, we'd be fed by air. And we were taught this all the way along. And it was quite true later on, as we found out.
Again, the problem of hygiene and sanitation on the move in the jungle.
Ah, yes.
How
well
did you overcome that?
There was no such things as latrine then. You just escaped away a few yards into the jungle and that was that.
And you do this yourself?
Yes, oh yes.
Mm-hmm. What if you were moving and you were bad to go?
Well, I've many times done it on the march, so That's number one. And number two is this. So you had to wait, I'm afraid, till the... Because I say, you always got these small rest periods, even to march and everything else. In on the march, even every hour, you had a 10-minute break, which were these functions.
You've mentioned various creatures and so forth. Again, in the jungle situation, did you sweat a great deal? Did you lose a great deal?
You were always wringing in sweat day and night. You were absolutely soaking wet through.
How did you combat that?
There was no way you could. You just live with it. That was all as simple as that. You couldn't combat it. It was absolutely impossible.
Were you...
This Belgaum, of course, would have been southern India. It was even hotter than where we'd been up in mid-Indian, north-Indian, Ahmednagar, places like that. It was much and more humid and much hotter compared to it. It was a different environment. A worse one, I would say. There's no doubt about that.
You would lose weight, presumably.
Well, that's a funny thing. Like, I'm probably just one of those persons, but you can believe it or not, my shape might have altered a little bit. But my weight now is exactly the same as it was in them days. And that's not heavy for my size of my body. I'm bulky. But even at this stage, I only weigh just under 10 stone. And it hasn't altered in 50 years.
You would need to replace the loss of liquid, in effect, in your body.
Again,
did you have drinks with
you? Yes. You had your tea, you see. Tea was always brewed up for you. Then on top of that, you had your water bottle, which was strapped on your left-hand side, to have a little tweak at. But again, you only drank when you really had to. You didn't make a habit of it, because it would never cool you down. Your water was warm for a start, out of your water bottle. So it wasn't to cool you down. It was to moisten your mouth more than cool you down, and to stop your mouth getting terribly dry. But as such, the more you drank, the more you sweated. It was as simple as that.
Were you given salt tablets, anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, we were given salt tablets to take. I think it was two of them a day took, and that was to replace the salt in your body, which you'd lost out of the perspiration.
How often did you get medicals or medical checkups?
At that stage, the only you got no more medicals as such. You had a... it wasn't as such as that, but if you went sick with a thing, obviously you were... If you went to a tummy ache or anything like that, you were examined then. But the main examination never occurred.
How long were you doing this training?
Well, again, it comes into my mind a place called Secunderabad. But I can't remember how I can remember the place. I can picture it in my eyes now. And the tales we heard about the Nizam of Hyderabad. Must have been somewhere near Begum, but it's just unfortunately one of them parts where I can't really follow it on. I don't know why, but it's just one of them lapses somehow or other. I remember Hyderabad, the state of Hyderabad, and a place called Secunderabad. But what I was doing, the faintest idea.
And this was before you went into the jungle
practice? Yes, that's right. We'll come to that now. What happened then was we did this training, then all of a sudden the rumours were flying and movements quickened up, and we were told we were going to end train within the next 2 or 3 days. Perhaps this was where the Secunderabad comes into it. Could have been. However, we were put under a troop train, and as such a big long train, and we were on that train for 7 days and seven nights, and that train took us right away up from southern India right up to the Assam border, where we got off the train at a place called Dimapur.
That's a long journey. You would obviously have starts and stops.
That's right. You slept and ate in there. But what you do? But even in that time, they kept you fit. What used to happen was periodically the train would stop. You would have to get out, and the train would stay away and leave you. And you would have to run along that track to the next station. And you would then train again, obviously, to keep you fit. And then, but apart from that, there's troops, because Indian trains were stopping and starting all the time. There's no such thing as a continuous run. But I remember another little small thing, only a small thing, but things would stick out, was to make a brew of tea at one of these stops. The train stopped, you took chatters, because sometimes the train would start moving off, and you'd have to jump back on the end of it. You'd dash up to the front of the train, if you're anywhere near it, with one of your Dixies, and get a can of hot water to make a brew of tea. the man used to put a lever in the engine, and out of one of the little pipes, it said, psh, would come the hot water, boiled water. You'd make a good cup of hot tea. And that went on for the 7 days and seven nights.
Were you being told where you were going?
I think we heard by rumour, but not officially, that we were going up onto the Assam border.
And you went to Dimapur, you said?
Dimapur, which was...
What happened there?
Yes, well, I'll tell you exactly what happened there. Now, for the last 30, 40 miles before we got to Dimapur, the train stopped more frequently, and much more activity ahead. There was patrols had to get off the train and go forward. They would come back and report nothing saying odd, and get back on the train and move forward. So obviously they were expecting the Japanese to be somewhere near there. This was even at the India side of Dimapur. Now Dimapur was the rail head, that's as far as the railway went. And we got off the train, and I remember, I think we were only there about 6 or 7 hours, well, it wasn't overnight. We got off the train, we had a mail, and then the next thing we were into trucks. And we were driving up the road into Assam from this railhead. And I think it would only be about 8 hours later we heard the first shots being fired in the war. And that was long before we got to Kohima, Garry's Mill or Kohima. And so there was, even at that stage, the Japs had penetrated much further towards India than where the Battle of Kohima was. But of course, obviously, at the extent of their communication lines, and only in small groups to cause harassment, obviously. But it did prove to us once and for all that we were really starting to get into the war, and that the Japs were trying to get into India as well at the same time.
How did you feel when you heard this activity?
At that stage, again, I keep repeating this, but it was true excitement. Not fear, that's the last thing in my mind. I was frightened later on, but at that stage, there was no fear. It was all new, that's what I was trained for, and I was quite content about it. If you got hit, that was just a misfortune.
And the men sitting around you, did they display the same attitude?
The same. You got the odd men, some people were more broody than others. I mean, it did affect some people, there's no doubt about that. You could tell some people even showed the fear and started to talk about it, but you used to just tell them to cheer up and, you know, make the lighter side of it, like, and sometimes it would help them. But my own person didn't. I would think the majority, not just me, was the same feeling that this is what you train for. You trained a lot of years and a long time. You put a lot of effort into it. You're really going to come to say what you've been trained for.
So those showing anxiety within your group, you helped?
Yes, oh yes, aye, I've talked to
Japanese. There was no threatening or anything like that?
Of course, I can understand it at this stage, because they didn't know, none of us knew what we were going into. We never dreamt what we were going to face in the next few days. Never dreamt, couldn't possibly dream that, a situation like that. You just thought of a war as right. You would see a soldier in front of you and either you shoot him or he shoot you, it's as simple as that. But in no way could anybody's imagination foresee what was to follow.
What kind of terrain were you moving into as you approached Kohima?
Yes, at this stage we were on a tarmacadam road, believe it or not. And this was the road what went from the railhead away into Burma, through Assam into Burma. And even what happened was, moving up this road, periodically we had to get out of the trucks, and you would detain as detachments away down into the jungles, either left and right side, all the way up that road, on patrol to say what you could find out and say if you could come across anybody. I remember one of them, and for some reason, again, there's things you can't understand. Now, we were doing a section, it was thick jungle, and this section of 10 of us, you took turns at all these duties. I was what you call tail end Charlie. And there was no firing, there was nothing going on, it was quiet.
You say tail end Charlie, what does that mean?
Yes, well, that is, as the section moved forward, you had a scout going in front, then you had your main group, in our case the section, move, and a scout was passing hand signals on whether he thought it was safe to carry on. And whereas Tail End Charlie was the chap at the rear, but quite a distance to the rear, whose duty was to protect the tail of that section. No, I was just saying, and I'd done it before with no apparent, but I don't know whether it was just the circumstances or hearing firing in this previous little melee what we'd had, that but I got a little bit frightened because I was out of touch with them. You could hear them moving forward, but you couldn't actually see your section in front of you. And I kept imagining there was Japanese up every tree on top of me. Because whereas the scouts in the patrols, we used to always say, you didn't mind being the scout. Because Japanese, funny little people that they are, would invariably let the scout go past. He wouldn't shoot him. But his main intention was to get the bulk of the section behind him, so the scout got away. But the tail end Charlie, you were a sitting duck. And if you once saw you, you'd drop your office, simple as that. But however, nothing came of it, purely in the mind, because nothing happened. Mm.